Those look good. Where'd you get them?
At the croquette station.
There's a croquette station?
Yeah, it's sort of between where the wedding stage is and the chicken and waffle truck.
Oh, near where you get the specialty cocktails?
Yeah.
This wedding is amazing.
Tell me again how you know these people.
Well, my brother taught archery to the younger sister of the bride.
And you got invited?
Well, our families got to know each other.
So I'm the boyfriend of the sister of the bride's sister's archery coach.
Yeah, that's right.
That must make me the guest with the highest degree of separation.
No, because see that woman over there in the low-cut dress?
Yeah.
Well, she's the date of Carl, who only just started jogging with the groom on weekday mornings about 3 months ago, and this is only her second date with Carl.
She wins.
Hey, did you try the teeny tiny grilled cheese sandwich sitting on top of the shot glass of tomato soup?
No, I'm getting one of the meatballs with the single strand of spaghetti wound up into a cone-shaped hat.
Today on the show, Jen Dahl talks about her wedding book, The Return of Mad Men, and the spoiler problem. Also, the Blood Moon Eclipse and Kevin Ollie's speech patterns. And now he's getting up to give another toast, Colin McEnroe.
It's actually, I usually don't give toasts at weddings. You might think that I would be the person who gives the toast at the wedding, but I'm actually a little bit, it's not that I'm toast averse, but I'd wait. I wait and see whether there's a toast that needs to be given. And if there isn't one that needs to be given, then I don't give one. Giving that a little bit more thought, that whole intro too, I think actually there's a person at every big wedding who not only is on his or her first date with one of the guests, but has only been invited is not even going out with that guest, has only been invited because that person does not want to show up unescorted. So that may be the person at any given wedding who has the largest degree of separation. However, I'm not the expert on that. That's Jen Dahl, who's with us right now. She's our super guest on today's Scramble. Let me tell you also what's coming up before we plunge into things with Jen. A little bit later, Christine Larson, acclaimed professor of astronomy at Central Connecticut State University. She's going to explain the Blood Moon Tetrad, which is the name also of the art rock band that John Dankosky had in college. But a Blood Moon Tetrad is actually a series of a certain kind of lunar eclipse. And we're about to have an unusual number of them resulting in the zombie apocalypse, the end of the world, stuff like that. All of that. And then there's been some writing recently about the way that Kevin Ollie talks. He's a basketball coach with an unusually vivid and powerful use of language. I think you could make the case that he's one of the more articulate basketball coaches. But he also speaks in a style of English that's sometimes called black English. And he's come into some criticism for that, or at least some people raising questions about it. We want to have a conversation about that. This man who really is a very vivid and powerful speaker. But there's some people, they just don't like the way he talks. So we'll talk about that later. Jen Dahl is with us. She is an acclaimed, fresh, and exciting voice. I just read that on Amazon.com. Jen Dahl writes for all kinds of publications, The Atlantic, The Hairpin, Mental Floss, The New York Magazine, New York Times Book Review. Her first book, Save the Date, The Occasional Mortifications of a Serial Wedding Guest, is out May 1st. We're going to come to that in just a second and talk a bit about the book. But before we do that, Jen Dahl, welcome back to our show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're very excited to have you. So one of the things that you do, and this has become sort of a massive journalism industry now, is to recap TV shows and analyze TV shows. And probably Mad Men is one of the most, if not the most, analyzed TV shows. There are many sites that devote considerable time and space to talking about each episode, often with critics and writers kind of going back and forth, talking among themselves about it. So that's something that you've done in the past, and you're doing it this year for Hairpin?
Yes, I am. My first post went up, I think, at noon today. So first post, first premiere, or the episode that came out last night, it's all up there and people are talking about it.
All right. So we're at the beginning of the home stretch of Mad Men. This is sort of the final season. I think it's only about 7 episodes, right?
I think so. Yeah. It's a short one. And then I think we get another. I might be wrong, actually.
Maybe it'll just keep on going. But who knows? But yeah. So anyway, Matthew Weiner is more or less in the process of starting to try to wrap this story up, a story that actually spans a longer period of time than I think I would have initially have guessed. I didn't realize. I mean, last night's episode, I think, has to be 1969 or so. So really have been through a lot of years with this show now.
Yes, definitely. Lots of changes. We saw Nixon in the episode that was on last night. So it's January 1969.
And first of all, for we won't do any spoilers. We're going to talk about spoilers later. We won't do any spoilers. But for you, what were the salient issues jumping up last night? Are there things that obviously this is kind of an exposition episode? It's the beginning of a seasonal arc. So there aren't going to be massive developments, but there are going to be hints about what right. the themes are. So what hints did you find?
Well, when we left at the end of season six, there was kind of this intimation that Peggy might be kind of falling into Don's footsteps and becoming the person who's really in charge. But this episode, we see that there's some developments there that are not exactly going the way Peggy wants them to go. I don't think that's a spoiler because I'm not going to say specifically what happens. But we also left Don and Megan with Megan moving to L.A. to start her film career or her TV career. And in this first episode, we see them back together still trying to make it work. Don heading out to LA, and that relationship clearly is in some trouble, which we knew from, you know, season six too. But I think it's like a slow, Mad Men has always had a pretty slow pacing and development. And I think we're getting hints at things that are going to progress over the episodes that we never really get one thing all at once, it feels like. So there's slow stuff, and it's also hard to say what Winer is necessarily doing because he tends to trick us. We think one thing and then it changes.
Right. Well, let me just paint, try to paint in slightly broader strokes too for people who haven't followed the series at all or haven't followed it all that carefully. So Mad Men sets a couple of different groups in opposition or at least in comparison to one another. One set of sort of dichotomies is the dichotomy between creative people and business people. Don Draper and his protege Peggy are the epitomes of creative people. They think creatively. Now, they're thinking creatively about Sunkist commercials and watch ads and stuff like that as opposed to writing gigantic novels or, you know, engaging in performance art. But they're the creatives. They try to think about excellence, about their own vision of excellence. They are constantly set at loggerheads with people who think about money and accounts and things like that. Sometimes these goals dovetail with one another, and sometimes these orientations, as I say, are going head to head. It seems to me the other two groups that are set in comparison to and sometimes in antipathy with one another are men and women. And to me, this is the most interesting thing about this series, which started in the early 60s and now is into the late 60s. It was very much initially about men of a certain type and of a certain generation, men who came out of either World War II or more likely Korea, and who were making a lot of money in this sort of this nascent world in which television and print advertising was sort of giving way to pure television advertising, and over the course of these seasons and over the elapsing of 9 or so years, to me, one of the most interesting things is that the men have become, not only on the series, but in the within the reality of the series, less and less relevant. And the women have become more and more relevant, which is kind of about right, really, for that period of time.
Mm-hmm. We've seen massive changes. You know, I mean, Joan is a partner now. And when she started out, she was obviously an incredibly together head of the secretary pool. But now she's partner. And the way that that happened has, I'm not going to, if people haven't seen the whole, see, if people haven't seen it, I don't want to spoil that. But the way that that came about involves some intense sexual issues and sexism and gender roles and all sorts of things. And then Peggy, of course, is sort of the up-and-comer who you see her starting to have a role like Don's role. And Don now is not drinking anymore. There are no more 3 martini lunches for him, but he's also not in charge in the way that he used to be. So there's a lot of fluctuation in those roles. And yeah, I think the women especially are so interesting because they're changing and it's not a clear path to like this utopian empowerment. It's really hard and there are repercussions for what they do. But with the men, it seems they're a little bit more lost and in flux.
Yeah, I think it's about a generation of men who were used to being cool when cool meant a highball and a cigarette and a certain kind of suit, and moving through the 60s, in which there were tremendous changes not only in style but in the substance of American life. And everything that they relied on to make themselves cool is kind of dribbling out like sand underneath their feet. And the question is, to what degree are they – one of the characters, Roger, is chameleon-like in his ability to adapt. He'll never look the part of a hippie or anything like that, but he can adapt to free love and drugs and orgies and stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, and sort of plausibly, a little bit ridiculously with his silver hair, trying to keep up with these 24-year-old drug-taking free love people. But, you know, it's in his nature, too. And with Don Draper, we have this guy who really – is an individualist and isn't really interesting of in changing for the sake of change, married to a much younger woman, a woman who's being embraced by Hollywood to some degree. Mm-hmm. And I guess he has to decide, right, how much he is willing to change.
Right. Well, and I mean, that's been through the course of the entire show. Who is Don? Who does Don think he is? What are the things that he clings to as real? Because he, too, is a chameleon, although a different kind than Roger. And he's faked a lot of what he is. You know, he's created this person. Now I think the moorings are a little bit lost. He doesn't know who he is anymore. And we're getting into the 70s, and he's trying to stick with Megan, but it doesn't seem like that's very satisfying. He's kind of at a loss with his job. I think it's going to be really interesting to see who he turns into this season, if he can get right, or if he's going to kind of just at the end of this episode, things didn't look wonderful for him. So,
you know, one of the ongoing debates about this, and it surfaces all the time, it surfaced most recently in a New Republic article by Mark Tracy, who's done the very thing that you're doing today here, is about the sort of the nature and quality of the series. And I admit that I've sort of gone back and forth a couple of times. Sometimes the series seems like this brilliantly curated take on a period of social change, which is sort of glued with wallpaper paste over, and very 60s wallpaper paste at that, over, you know, a kind of standard soap opera, or at least over a set of machinations that don't really add up to very much. Who ultimately cares who gets the sun-kissed account, if that's the big prize at the end of the day? Mm-hmm. There's sort of that. But then there are other times at which it really feels like Matthew Weiner is the Henry James of the 1960s, you know, that he really is using the style of a culture and the dramas of people who in their own right may not be the most dramatic and important people in the world to say profound things about human psychology. And so I'm guessing I know where you come down, but come down somewhere on that one.
Well, you know, I think that there are arguments to be made about every show that they're not all that we're trying to get out of them. But the same way with Girls, that you can look at that show, you can look at Mad Men, and you can say, no matter what, this is a quality TV show. This is better than a lot of stuff out there. So, yeah, maybe it's over-stylized, and yeah, maybe we're trying to feel smart by watching it, and so we put a lot of emphasis on what it means, and maybe it doesn't always pay off, but I think it pays off more than a lot of things.
Yes, there are worse things that you could be watching. So let's add to this conversation before we get to your book, which people should be reading instead of watching television anyway. But before we get to your book, the other thing you and I have been sort of emailing about this morning, too, is the whole question of spoilers. Now, last night, in fact, there weren't too many spoilers to worry about in Mad Men, but there were in Game of Thrones. And increasingly, we have this very confused media landscape. And first of all, the platforms on which people watch things have become wildly varied, from something like Netflix, in which a whole season drops in its entirety, 15 or so episodes of House of Cards. You can watch them all in one weekend or spread them out depending on your inclination. Some people watch things on demand. Some people catch up. Some people are a season behind. Mr. Dankosky here is he's two episodes behind. He's finished up season three of Game of Thrones, but other people are two seasons behind. You never know when you're talking to somebody about Breaking Bad or The Good Wife or Game of Thrones or True Detective or any of these must-watch series, whether the person's watched the same episode that you've watched, and people become really concerned that you are going to spoil something for them. And they have their own definitions, too, about what a spoiler is. But so how do you told me you don't really mind spoilers personally
I'm
that
weird.
Much.
Weird. I like spoilers because to me it allows me to relax, and especially in a really tense show. And I admit I haven't watched Game of Thrones mostly because I don't like tense shows, and I know a lot of really scary and bad things happen on that show.
I'll tell you one thing. The show would have materially altered your wedding book. But anyway, continue.
But, you know, a lot of people now are watching TV shows and they're on Twitter at the same time that they're watching TV shows. Mm-hmm. And that's where the water cooler conversation that you might have had when you go into the office the next day and say, did you watch Mad Men? What did you think? That's actually where the real-time water cooler conversation is happening. And so part of the fun of watching those shows and being on Twitter does involve spoilers because you're talking about what's going on. Then for people who don't want to know the spoiler, well, you shouldn't be on Twitter for sure, because you're probably going to run into something you don't want to hear. And then with the speed of websites posting their recaps pretty quickly, you do have to kind of walk around very carefully if you're going to avoid spoilers.
I think there's
to me,
yeah. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Like the story isn't about. To me, the plot isn't the most important part of a TV show. And I know that that's weird and a lot of people don't think that. I like to see the things happen and I want to see how they're going to play out, even if I do know what happens.
Well, I think also there are all kinds of classist issues that come up. I mean, people who don't have a full subscription to HBO treat people who do like they're Russian oligarchs of some kind. So you're the kind of jerk who gets the HBO show right when you want it, whenever the premiere is. And then there's when it comes to Game of Thrones, there's a whole other group of people who have read the books and are openly contemptuous of people who are waiting with bated breath to see what the TV set tells them is the story. And if you go onto social media with any concerns about what's going on Game of Thrones, as if it were freshly baked bread, you will be immediately taunted by these people. So I guess we have sort of all kinds of stratifications, right?
Right. Well, right. Like what does happen when you read the book? Is it spoiled for you when you see it play out on TV? I wouldn't think that it would be personally, because it's a totally different venue in which you're watching it and different things can be put together in different ways. And I think it would still be exciting, but maybe not. Maybe it's ruined because you know what happens.
All right. We got to, for our final topic here with Jen Dahl, we do want to talk about the book that you have coming out. So explain this book. Explain the genesis of this book. This book arises from your own experience. You,
yes.
Like all of us, one of the sort of common threads of humankind is that over the course of a lifetime, we will go to many weddings.
Yes. And even more, I think, in contemporary society than we ever have, because people get married later and people marry more than once. And it seemed like, you know, as I was looking back at my life, one of the most common themes at different points when I'm a totally different person was that I was going to weddings, whether I was an 8-year-old going to my first wedding that I can remember of relatives, or a 25-year-old going to my first destination wedding of my college best friend, or, you know, a wedding where I suddenly have a new boyfriend and I'm bringing him as my date. All the different iterations in which we go to weddings and what that lens of wedding going tells us about ourselves, because you don't go to weddings as a blank slate. You don't go to weddings purely invested, unfortunately, maybe, in the bride and groom or whoever's getting married. You know, you're about you, too, and you've got your story that you bring to that scenario. Sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's not so good.
Well,
and
without doing a spoiler, give us an example from the book of a time when your own story was your story at that wedding.
Mm-hmm. Well, overpowered the it doesn't overpower necessarily. I think most of the weddings I've been to have been extremely enjoyable, and I'm very happy for the couples. One sort of funny story is that I was going to a wedding in Jamaica for a good friend of mine who happened to have her husband-to-be had gone to college with a guy that I'd in 12th grade competed in a debate tournament with, and he beat me, and I didn't think he should have. And so we're in Jamaica, and I'm confronting him, this guy, you know, 20 years later, and seeing what's going to happen. So people from your past come up again, you know, when you go to weddings, and that can be funny and weird, and that storyline is its own special moment.
Yeah, I think there's this intellectual commitment to the notion that the bride and groom are paramount at the weddings, and so and their right. happiness is paramount. It's their special day. Every other possible subsidiary consideration should be relegated to no status at all in mm-hmm. order for them to have the most epic possible experience.
Right.
The problem is nobody ever does it, right? You have about two or three drinks, and then suddenly your own issues come up.
Oh, my gosh. And how can you suppress your emotions in this incredibly emotional moment? The other thing that I think is interesting and what I wanted to get at with this book is the idea that we do all have feelings. We do bring our feelings to these weddings, but weddings aren't just about the couple getting married. They're about the families, and they're about the interpersonal relationships between all the people there. You know, whether it's like someone who is kind of this tertiary guest that no one really knows, or your best friend is getting married and you're not sure how you feel about her spouse. All of these interrelationships play an incredibly important role in a wedding dynamic. And it's like a wedding has its own sort of ecosystem where these people are entwined in each other's lives for a temporary but extremely emotional period of time.
Yeah, actually, I think, as was suggested in the intro, that one of the most liberating positions at a wedding is to be that tertiary guest, the guest with the only the most remote connection to the bridal party, the person who was invited as a matter of table completion or right. some other consideration.
You're like the only person who can have fun if you're that guest.
Yeah, I mean, I at least do find that. Well, are you anticipating, and maybe it's already happening, are you anticipating that you are now going to be regarded as a font of information and maybe even sort of Solomon-like judgments, that you are going to be the Ann Landers / Amy Dickinson of wedding questions?
Oh, my gosh. Well, maybe. You know, I am getting – it's funny. Conversations turn to weddings around me inevitably. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why that is, but I am getting etiquette questions. I'm not sure I'm always the right person to answer it, because if you read my book, a lot of it is admitting to mistakes that I've made at weddings and some etiquette disasters. But I guess that's a kind of expertise. You know, you don't want to make the same mistake twice, right?
I think also, you know, another, you know, just to sort of go back to one of the your original statement that we go to more weddings maybe than mm-hmm. previous generations did. The ease of travel has also made that. I mean, in other words, you know, if you were at home in Boston in 1886 and there was a wedding in Deadwood, I mean, you just didn't go to it.
Right.
And whereas now people can go anywhere. And so somebody who's I was recently invited to somebody's second marriage, second wedding. I'm in Connecticut. The wedding is an hour and a half outside of Houston. This would have been an implausible thing to attend.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't even have to explain why you were not attending. But in this day and age, right, you conceivably might need to go to that wedding.
Right, and it's a bigger deal too. You know, I don't think that weddings had the same sort of blow the top off, make it the most unique experience possible, you know, spend all the money that you can possibly spend, $40,000, $150,000, you know, these crazy price tags. That wasn't what weddings were like in the old days. And so now both you can go to a destination wedding in the Dominican Republic or Jamaica or wherever it happens to be, and the cost of going is something that you look at and think, well, do I want to do this? Is this worth it? If I don't go, am I no longer friends with these people? Am I no longer part of their life? So everything is like a little more fraught, I think. And there's that possibility to go, but also the cost can be kind of crazy.
Another thing that you did, we're going to wrap up here pretty soon, Jen Dahl, but another thing you did was research wedding traditions. This turned into a piece for Mental Floss. So a lot of things that you would have thought were maybe just really deeply ingrained in the notion of a wedding are newer than one might have expected, right? For example, the white,
yes.
white wedding dress is not that new.
Exactly. That was Queen Victoria wearing it. And there had been white wedding dresses before, but she was the one who really put it on the map as an important thing to do. I also love that the bridesmaids, there was like a lot of trying to ward off evil spirits and prevent the bride, who was considered the lucky one, from being maybe kidnapped by another groom or, you know, stolen. So the bridesmaids had to wear the same dress as the bride to confuse people, which is confuse evil spirits, which is kind of
We should also
funny.
Say that Queen Victoria was, I believe, the first person ever to say, all the single ladies, put your hands up. up in the club. I think that's credited to her. Listen, Jen Dahl, it was great to talk to you. We can't wait for May 1st when, in fact, this book, Save the Date, The Occasional Mortifications of a Serial Wedding Guest, comes out. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
We'll be back.
Enough to cross, enough to last, till the end of time. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just to live on. What the world needs now.
All right, you may have encountered the notion of the blood moon, the lunar eclipse, and we've got not only one of them coming, but really four of them coming. We wanted to know what this means and how it's possible, and even for those of us who didn't take an excellent astronomy course taught by someone like Christine Larson at Central Connecticut State University, how a lunar eclipse actually works. I always know with eclipses that they represent the interposition of something in between the path of the sun and something else. But other than that, I'm kind of clueless. So anyway, she's the recipient of the 2013 Walter Scott Houston Award from the Northeast Region of the Astronomical League for service to astronomy, education, and outreach. She's going to perform more of that service right now on this show. Christine Larson, good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, Colin. And you did give us a spoiler that there's an eclipse tonight.
Right, there's an eclipse tonight, and the world will not end also. That's the other spoiler.
That is also a spoiler, yeah.
Yeah. So there's an eclipse tonight. And so when we say there's a lunar eclipse, and that it's actually sometimes called a blood eclipse because of the redness of it, what event are we talking about? What's actually happening up there in the sky?
Well, we're talking about the sun, the earth, and the moon lining up in a very particular way so that the earth is in the middle and it's casting a shadow on the moon.
And so does that explain the whole blood part of this, the redness part of it? Is the light passing through the earth's atmosphere? Is that what's making the redness?
Right. We block out with the body of the earth most of the sunlight that would reach the moon, but a little bit of sunlight, in particular the red part of the sunlight, sneaks through our atmosphere and illuminates the moon, hence making it blood red.
Now, I'm going to ask how often this happens, but that's actually kind of a complicated question, right? It doesn't happen exactly with the same frequency all the time.
Right. On average, we get about two lunar eclipses a year, but not all lunar eclipses are created equal. Sometimes the shadow of the Earth just grazes the moon. Sometimes we get the outer part of the shadow, and you don't really see much going on. And so this is really great because we get four total lunar eclipses in a row over the next 2 years.
And how spaced out will they be?
Well, we have one tonight. We have one October 8th. We have one next April 4th and another one next September 28th.
And so tonight's, I'm hearing cloud cover and stuff like that. Is there any hope we'll be able to see this thing?
Yeah, I'm not holding out a whole lot of hope, but you know how the weather goes in New England. So I'd say that if you're up around 3 a.m, look out the window and cross your fingers.
And you may have already said this, but as I was struggling to absorb all this new information, I might have missed it. This is called a tetrad, right, where there's four of them in a period of time. How completely unusual is this?
It's not as unusual as people would think. There was a tetrad back in 2003, and there'll be another one in 2032. The one that's occurring now is really kind of interesting because we here in Connecticut will be able to see at least parts of all four of the lunar eclipses.
Now, the minute there's anything like this, and people start combing back through Nostradamus and any other set of predictions that they can find. And I first of all assume that if these so-called blood moon tetrads are not that unusual, they really shouldn't be any cause for people to believe that the zombie apocalypse is any more imminent than it is on any other given day.
No, unfortunately. Oh, that would be Walking Dead spoilers, wouldn't it, Colin?
That would be actually, yeah.
That would, yes. No, I mean, as I said, lunar eclipses happen all the time, and these tetrads occur occasionally. And I think part of it is that if you've ever seen a lunar eclipse, seeing that blood red color on the moon is quite frightening. When I was a young child, I saw one. My parents didn't think to tell me there was a lunar eclipse, and I got up in the middle of the night and saw one. And let's say that I really have sympathy for how the ancient people were scared to death of these things.
Any particular advice? I mean, let's assume that the cloud cover pulls off because this is, as you say, New England. This isn't the kind of thing where you can hurt your eyes or anything like that,
no,
right?
No, perfectly safe.
And any other particular advice about sort of how to watch it, where to look for it?
Well, you'll be looking in the southern to southwest part of the sky. Obviously, if you have a pair of binoculars, that's great. You can see the moon a little more up close and personal, but you can do it with just your eyes. You can look out the window, any window that's facing in the right direction, or you can go outside and look up. And unlike a solar eclipse, a lunar eclipse is more leisurely. So if you have to go back inside and get something to drink, you're not going to miss too much.
There's no pause button, though.
No pause button.
And so is this specific to North America just because of the way it's lining up?
This one in particular, North America is in a really good position for this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, Christine Larson, it's great to know about all this stuff. It will enrich our evening, assuming that we get the clouds. There's nothing we can do to make the clouds go all right. They're just going to be there, right?
I don't have any magic button, do you?
No, as 21st century media consumers, we're very accustomed to getting what we want when we want it. But that's the great thing about astronomy. Sometimes you just have to put up with what's up there in the heavens. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
All right. When we come back, we are going to have a conversation about Kevin Ollie, whose speech patterns are the occasion for at least one piece in The Current. I've read other things as well. I want you. I hunt you down. Underneath the blood moon. Chasing your dreams. Your mind, you lost it.
So basically, Creedence Clearwater Revival was right. I am definitely not going around tonight. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our intern is Skylar Magnoli. Greg Hill appeared in our intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff doing the electric slide at weddings where nobody else is doing the electric slide, visit WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, how our notion of public space changes after a tragedy like the Boston bombing. And now, back to Colin.
You know, she makes a good point, which is that a Creedence Clearwater Revival in Bad Moon Rising, which first of all, for quite a few years, I thought was, there's a bathroom on the right. And I was not alone in thinking that. But the exhortation is, don't go around tonight. What does go around mean? I mean, does it mean you have to stay home? Or is there like a certain circuit you're not supposed to make? I mean, what is it? How do you even follow that advice? It would be good to know on the night of another blood eclipse. Joining us right now is author Rand Cooper. He is an author, essayist, freelance writer, restaurant critic for The New York Times. He's here today because he pointed out to me an article written by Dan Tapper. Dan Tapper's kind of a PR guy. I believe he's still with Sullivan and Lachine. And this arises from actually something that has kind of been percolating for a while, which is that Kevin Ollie, the coach of the UConn Husky men's team, if you've listened to him speak, he uses language, I think, powerfully and vividly in a lot of ways, and more so than probably most coaches do. But when he's doing that, I mean, the images that he chooses are often quite powerful and quite imaginative, too. But when he does this, he does often speak in a dialect, in sort of a black dialect, an African-American kind of urban dialect. So he'll say, Ray Allen and me, we was drafted on the same day. He'd say, the only difference is I don't play point guard no more. He commits those kinds of what we might call grammatical errors. And he's been called on it by a number of sports writers and columnists around the country, in particular Phil Mushnick of the New York Post, who took a shot at Kevin Ollie. It seems to bother a lot of emailing folks, he says, especially Connecticut taxpayers, that UConn's second season UConn educated and graduated basketball coach Kevin Ollie is so painfully deficient in fundamental spoken grammar. And Dan Tapper has taken up Kevin Ollie's cause to defend him against this. So, Rand Cooper, you were the one who pointed this essay out to me and had some interesting things to say about it. So I'm going to hand it off to you right now. I do want to say this is the kind of thing people do tend to have opinions about. So our number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266.
Well, my goal is not really to have an opinion about this, but just to outline some of the, to me, very interesting questions that it raises. And I will say about a week ago, I met briefly with an acquaintance who is a huge supporter of UConn basketball, has been actually involved in various ways with the program for years, loves Kevin Ollie, and we were both enthusing about what was going on with the team. And the guy said to me, man, do I love Ollie. I love everything he's doing. But then he said, almost sort of sotto voce, he said, but I just wish he didn't sound like that. It and he winced a little, and he said it's just a little cringe making for someone who represents the University of Connecticut, who's a graduate of University of Connecticut, to say things like, "Hey, we ain't got no regrets." Mm-hmm. And what I liked about Dan Tapper's piece is that, and Dan Tapper is, as you said, he's in PR. My friend was saying this is terrible PR for UConn. Dan Tapper's piece argues very persuasively that Kevin Ollie is great PR for UConn, including the way he talks, not despite the way he talks, but including it. And he offers a closely reasoned defense of this. And among other things, he points to certain homespun maxims that that Kevin Ollie uses, like take the stairs, not the escalator, plant the seeds for success. And he says, and then he traces Ollie's background. He says his voice and inflection is that of someone raised in Texas and in an impoverished urban area. We are a nation of accents, from the dropped R's of New England to the clip patterns of the northern states to the drawl of the deep south. It means nothing in the way of education or intelligence or thoughtfulness or how effectively one communicates. And he says Kevin Ollie, including the way he speaks, is to be celebrated. And I find this is generally a very polarizing issue. And there are a lot of people who think it's simply and obviously the case that no one who has attained that position should be speaking so ungrammatically. Dan Tapper's arguments are very persuasive otherwise, and they put Kevin Ollie in the tradition of sort of American homespun rhetoric. But to me, and this is to move on to the question that it raises, is really a question about the uses, the purposes, and the limitations of standard English. And that's what Dan Tapper is really arguing against. He's arguing against the idea that everyone who reaches a position of authority, attainment, and accomplishment has to sound more or less the same way. And this is an enduring cultural linguistic argument. It's not merely an American argument. And it's certainly not merely about racist charges, which Dan Tapper says the New York Post guy took an unprovoked and racially charged shot. But if you go to, for instance, in the UK, the argument about so-called BBC English has been raging for years. Should all BBC announcers sound like they were fabricated in the same factory, or could regional dialects, which in the UK vary even more greatly than ours do, should a Welshman be on the BBC sounding like he's from
deep Wales?
No, absolutely not. Or Scotland? So we have. I would put this in the context of that larger argument. And I would just say two other things. I would push back a little bit, if you want to make the opposite argument, against Dan Tapper. And one counterpoint might be to note that Kevin Ollie got his job, his great job, by virtue of a number of things. One, he had a fabulous and very hardworking NBA career. He was a celebrated star at this university, and he was anointed by Jim Calhoun. In other words, he was not a guy who was trudging from interview to interview, carrying his CV with him and trying to convince an interviewer to hire me. Now, most of the people who play basketball at UConn are not going to be in the NBA. They are someday going to be that person trudging from interview to interview. And one can argue coherently that those people may well be substantially inconvenienced if they speak in their interview the way Kevin Ollie speaks. So there are always.
It might even be fair to ask whether at Sullivan and Lachine, where Dan Tapper works, they would hire a candidate who said, "I don't want to write that kind of press release no more."
It's an excellent question. And Colin, you had the show about language a few weeks ago, and you had the brilliant guy from Merriam-Webster on, who, by the way, kicked my butt in a language contest in West Hartford a few years ago. I'll never forget that. When you got him to try to argue, or when a caller did, to argue for a very prescriptive approach to grammar, all he would say is, look, I will tell you that if you use non-standard grammar in situation X, Y, or Z, you're liable to run into some trouble. So there's a strong practical argument to be made. And then there are some, we can get in these if you want, I think some cultural arguments to be made for standard language.
All right, let's grab a call or two. A lot of people did call in about this. Here's George in Avon. Hi, George.
I guess I come down on the side of he's a representative of UConn. UConn is an institute of higher learning, and it made me embarrassed. I also wanted to say that the way that the players acted at the presentation ceremony made me embarrassed a little bit too. And they just really didn't seem to act like mature winners. And so I just hope for better things from UConn.
I didn't really have any problem with how the players acted. I thought they acted pretty much the way I would have acted at the age of 20 or 21 in the middle of something very exciting. I didn't see any untoward behavior but anyway, just to go back to the thing about whether it's embarrassing the way that he talks, I would just want to bring up two issues, and then we have some more calls here. One of them is what's now called code switching, something Gene Demby writes about a lot for NPR. I mean, President Obama, upon buying some kind of food from an African-American vendor, was offered change back from his money, and he looked at the vendor and said, "No, we straight." Now, President Obama knows how to speak the King's English when he wants to. And so this is called code switching, that in this environment, it made sense for President Obama, who also has been a community organizer in urban settings, to talk to that man the way that he talks. And so I actually wonder, I watched a bunch of Kevin Ali interviews and press conferences to get ready for this. I didn't have time to really immerse myself. But I had a little bit of a sense that this is something that he's somewhat in control of and can turn it on and off a little bit. I watched him get through one fairly lengthy press conference without ever doing anything like what we're talking about now. I watched other interviews where he was just lapsing into that kind of speech all the time. I don't know how intentional it is, but there is a thing called code switching where you make a decision about how you're going to speak.
This is a huge point. I haven't seen enough of Kevin Ali to conclude whether he's capable of that. My impression is no. Certainly nothing approaching what Obama can do. But this twin tracking or multiple tracking of one's language is sort of the magic trick of identity that assimilation that immigrant groups have pulled off in American life. And it bears interest for many generations. It bears interesting relationship to one's own identity. And Obama is a fascinating example. Some people respect him for this and some people mistrust him for this, of being able to switch depending on his audience, and to sound however he needs to sound. Now, there's a chameleon-like quality to that, and there's a great adept facility with language that you have to have in order to have that. The great writers who've written books in regional colloquial language have always been people who, of course, first mastered standard English and then decide for artistic purposes how they're going to depart from it. So that ability, one, to operate from a base of standard English and then deviate from it strategically, artistically, for whatever your purpose is you know, part of the fascination of language in American culture.
Let me grab a call from Jim in Canton. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
You're on the air.
I'm not from Connecticut, didn't go to UConn, so not a big UConn fan, but I think Kevin Ali does engage in this, as it's called, code switching a bit. I recall watching, I think it was the second round NCAA game, and the fact that I can't remember shows that I'm not a huge fan. UConn was down at halftime. Kevin Ali was coming off the court, and, you know, as they do the short interviews with the coaches, and normally the coaches utter some vacuous banalities, and Kevin Ali, very calmly, self-confident, but not in an arrogant way, said, "We're going to come back and win this game." And I was impressed that he had the confidence in himself and in his team to make that kind of a comment in a very calm manner. I was impressed by it.
Well, certainly, first of all, you know, Phil Mushnick is the guy from the New York Post who brought this up. Although, as I looked around today, I found some other places in markets far away from Connecticut in which note has been taken of the way that Kevin Ali talks, which is a little bit different from the way most high-level college basketball coaches talk. And just two quick things about that. One of them is, right now in Connecticut, the surest way to be tarred and feathered is to say anything negative about Kevin Ali. Everybody, for pretty good reasons, worships the guy right now, and it just, you know, being the skunk at the garden party isn't really going to work for a lot of people. But I think the other thing, Rand, that I'm wondering about, when people are troubled by this way that he talks, really we are talking very specifically about race, Because, for example, I mean, think of all the other high-level college basketball coaches. Imagine Lefty Driesell in a post-game interview. Or, for that matter, imagine Jim Calhoun, who doesn't misuse grammar in a particular way, but speaks in this kind of Joycean babble that's almost impossible at times to parse or even extract the exact meaning from. Transcribing Calhoun when he was in one of his kind of high-energy rants was really a challenge to even figure out what the sentence structure was that he was engaging in, peppering it constantly with the phrase, quite frankly, quite frankly, quite frankly, which he used kind of the way people use commas, just sprinkled all the way through. And I'm not picking on Jim Calhoun. Most college basketball coaches, or many college basketball coaches, mangle English in one way or another. There's something special about doing it in sort of an urban black idiom.
Well, first of all, as the other caller implied, there's also every situation in which someone speaks situationally with all certain limitations constitutes a sort of code. It's often the code of athletes and of coaches to say, as the caller implied, essentially nothing. And so when someone breaks that code, as Gino Auriemma often does, and as Kevin Ollie does, it's refreshing. No matter how they couch it grammatically, it's a refreshing transgression of the normal code of saying nothing. I agree with you, Colin, that many of these comments do have a racial tint, and that's because so many of these kinds of issues do have racial axes to them. As you know, I lived in Germany for a number of years. Helmut Kohl was the chancellor when I was there. As in Britain, in Germany, there is really a codified high language, Hochdeutsch, that forms a standard expectation that anyone who's educated or in power is expected to speak. Helmut Kohl was famous as the first German chancellor who, as it was said, cannot speak high German. Now, he was, on the one hand, mocked and mimicked for this. But at the same time, in a roundabout way, he was also loved for it. And there was a great ambivalence about that because on the one hand, it was seen as sort of embarrassing in much this way. His accent was this lilting, bucolic one from a remote part of Germany, a lovely part of Germany, and people impersonated him. But at the same time, in a demotic kind of way, he was felt to be therefore closer to the people and they embraced him for it. So there is always this ambivalence, and I think we see that with Kevin Ollie.
Let me grab a call from Prasad in Avon. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if there was a distinction being made between you talked about code switching before, but his verbal way he talks versus writing or, you know, stuff like that. There was a distinction being made in this whole conversation between those two.
I think a distinction can be made. I don't know that we have a clear enough example of how Kevin Ollie writes as to in order to be able to apply it to him. But certainly the way people speak and the way they write, they're just huge dichotomies.
The other thing is that Kevin Ollie is a basketball player and a recent basketball player, and he speaks the way his basketball players speak. Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting dimension in that, too. There has typically been, and not only for white coaches, but if you think about the great black coaches like John Thompson, for instance, there has always been a separation, usually in age, in some certain ways in educational attainment, and also in diction, and Ollie has effaced and erased that, and in some ways it certainly brings him closer to his players and puts him right in their milieu. That might be hard for some coaches because it doesn't give them that distance into which authority is naturally built. With him, it seems to be working pretty well.
Yeah, I do think that if he's doing some code switching, if he's at least leaning into this a little bit more heavily, this style of speech more heavily on some occasions than he does on other occasions, it may have to do with exactly what you talked about. This was an occasion. This season was an occasion that demanded a sense of solidarity. You had a team that had been punished the year before, a team that was coming back not only athletically but academically, improving its program, but at the same time it lost two players to the NBA, had lost two more players who transferred out in order to avoid the sanctions. He really sort of had to gather his players around some kind of central core, some kind of nucleus of enthusiasm. And I wonder if in talking that way, not using university speak, but using basketball speak, he was doing a little bit of code switching and trying to emphasize his solidarity with them.
You know, Colin, there are some, and again, I could sit here and make a pretty compelling list of arguments for the other side of this, but let's just draw this out. There are many ways in which one can be inspiring to other people. And some of them have to do with language, but most do not. And the list of things that Kevin Ollie has done, both in his career and as coach, by way of overcoming adversity, showing perseverance, and really modeling, to use the word again and again for his players, important life qualities, makes him a pretty superlative figure as a coach.
And I think he wants Shabazz Napier to be able to use the kind of language that he uses, the kind of diction that he uses, but also the other kind as well. And if you listen to Napier right. and a lot of those other players speak, they're not going to have a hard time getting through a job interview. They can talk the way that they need to when they need to, and I think that's very important to Kevin Ollie. This is very important. We have to go. Thanks to Rand Cooper. Thanks to Jen Dahl. Thanks to Christine Larson. We'll be back tomorrow with a more serious show about the way public attitudes get transformed by disasters and tragedies like the Boston Marathon, which will have been 1 year prior. Using these words for the bettering of mankind. Yes, it's I who's choosing these words that are new to me, sifting thoughts brutally to straighten up. I'm Kyan Wolf, and I would just like to say, may your wedding end in fewer violent murders than any wedding in Game of Thrones. I'm sorry, spoiler alert.